Hello, everyone. Good day to you wherever you might be in terms of global time zones. My name is Cameron Petrie, and I'm here to welcome you to the latest installment of the BIPS webinar series, which is running with great regularity. And today we have the great honor I have the great honor of hosting Professor Eberhard Sauer, who is based in the University of Edinburgh. Eberhard has studied at the University of Tübingen and the University of Oxford, come to the UK and has extended a period of archaeological research and background in terms of working on the fortification walls on the northern parts of Iran. And those of you who have been paying attention will be more than aware of the scale and importance of Eberhard's contribution, working as part of a leadership group of a very large collaborative team that's been involved with a range of different sorts of excavation, geomorphology, and large-scale remote sensing activities. He's published several books, and today I think we have the honor and the pleasure of hearing him speak about the next installment under the title Ancient Arms Race, Antiquity's Largest Fortress and Sasanian Military Networks of Northern Iran. But Eberhard, I'd like to welcome you to the seminar and in a sense hand over the floor to you and let you take us away for the next little while. And please give us a tour of the fortifications of Northern Iran. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Cameron. Thank you very much for the kind introduction. And it's a great pleasure to present some of the very many highlights from our recent work in Iran to the British Institute of Persian Studies, who of course has supported our project ever since its beginning in 2005. And I should point out that this is a lecture that's not just by me, but notably also by my colleague, Dr. Shehbal Nokande, the director of the National Museum of Iran, and Hamid Omrani Rekavandi, the director of the Great Gorgon Wall Cultural Base. But it's only me who will be speaking for about half an hour, and afterwards I would very much welcome to attempt to answer any questions that you may have. You see the covers of the two volumes of this book, the third, which BIPS has kindly published in their series. And of course, those of you who are familiar with our earlier research might be asking themselves, is there really anything new? They've been doing work in Iran for a very long time and have published one big book on this before. Is there anything new to say about the project? Now, I think there's a lot that is new. And in this particular lecture, I will specifically focus on what will feature in our book, which is our work in northeastern Iran, notably on the Gorgon Wall, which you see here, as well as in Khorasan, work with Maizam Labafkhaniki, and at Kali Iraj, where we excavated with Mohammad Reza Nemati and Mehdi Musavinya. Our large ERC Persian Its Neighbors project also explored Darya Ali Fort in Georgia, that's now fully published, so I will not talk about this, as well as the Fulaj Fort in Oman, that was I played a very small role in this only, that was mainly done by Seth Priestman, Nasser Al-Jawri, and Derek Kennett, and that will also not feature in tonight's lecture. What will feature are also various huge fortifications in the hinterland, some of them of almost 2 square kilometer size. But let us first of all focus specifically on the area that features most prominently in our research project, which is the area of the Gorgon Wall. The Gorgon Wall, which you see here, is the longest fault-lined barrier in the late antique Near East, or indeed all over the late antique Near East or Mediterranean world. And of course, we've known about the Gorgon Wall for a long time, and we've dated it to probably the 5th century in our previous phase of the project. But there's a lot that is new in our more recent project. Very interestingly, for example, we had not known when we published the previous book that there is a whole chain of forts along the old Gorgon River. So there seems to be, before the Gorgon Wall is built, a range of smaller fortifications such as Burak Tepe, about which we'll hear more in a moment, and a range of other Sasanian forts along the Gorgon River. We knew before that there are huge campaign bases, but we only knew that they were roughly contemporary to the Gorgon Wall. But many of the huge sites in the hinterland, such as this one here, Gabri-Calais, we now can date precisely and know that some of these were built before the Great Wall. And we have got new discoveries, in particular Kristen Hopper and the landscape team have discovered this huge fortification, about 60 hectares, which is yet another fortifications to show to us that the Gorgon Plain was, I think, arguably the most heavily defended landscape anywhere within the late antique world. Let us focus first of all on this limes on the old Gorgon River, and we shall focus in on the fort of Burak Tepe here. At the top slide, you see the Gorgon Wall itself and two of its over 30 forts. About 2 kilometers south of it, you see here a giant campaign base around 650 meters across. Another 2 kilometers south, you may notice a very, very tiny dot. And this very, very tiny dot is Burak Tepe, which is this fort that you do see here on the right of the screen. Burak Tepe is sitting right on the now dried up course of the old Gorgon River and probably guarded a river crossing at the time. Now, when we explored it, we succeeded in getting a range of radiocarbon dates, and they, in conjunction with the pottery analysis by Maria Dagmeci and others now suggest very strongly that Burak Tepe is probably just a little earlier than the Gorgon Wall, probably built in the earlier 5th century AD. So you first build a chain of forts, and then only later do you build this massive linear barrier. We carried out a geophysical survey that suggests that it's a fort which differed in architecture from the Gorgon Wall fort. So we have a courtyard. We excavated just a very tiny trench for the purposes of dating evidence. And however, unfortunately, due to extensive robber tunnels by people who have investigated the site privately before us, the earlier stratigraphy was more disturbed than we would have wished. We nonetheless learned quite a great deal about this fort. So as I've said, it's probably courtyard fort, but probably here you just see in dark gray, the shaded area. That's the area taken up by accommodation. And you see that's probably about as much in the small Burak Tepe fort as in Gorgon Wall Fort 2, which is one of the smaller forts on the Gorgon Wall, but more than twice the size. So about a very small but very, very heavily defended fort. And you see here in size comparisons with other Sasanian forts, also courtyard forts, also probably with accommodation on the inside of the walls on the left side, and various late Roman forts, some of them of similar architecture, on the right side. So it may have had a similar holding capacity, and our excavations do suggest that later, maybe around the time the Gorgon Wall was built, but we can precision date it, the occupation density of Burak Tepe may have fluctuated massively. So there may have been phases when it was partially or completely abandoned, then other phases when it was again more heavily occupied. But enough about the forts in the hinterland, let us move on to the Gorgon Wall. And our main investigations focused on two trenches, which were towards the eastern end of the lowland section of the Gorgon Wall. We excavated in Fort 2, and we also carried out a geophysical survey on a section of the Gorgon Wall that had not previously been known, linking Fort 2 with Fort 2A, which is just off the map to the left. And very interestingly, mainly thanks to the leadership of Gebrel Nokande, were we able also to excavate this massive bridge on which the Gorgon Wall here is crossing one of its weak points, the river crossing of the Sarre Saulx. This survives to a height of around 7.5 meters. So this makes it the highest preserved section of the Gorgon Wall that we know, and it's not preserved to anywhere near its top, if of course the bridge may not be represented of the height of the wall in the lowland section. So a massive undertaking. And our excavation also established, here you see some of the excavation in progress, and here that's the bridge pier, more heavily robbed on one side of the river and the less heavily robbed pier on the opposite side of the river. And one thing that did become dramatically clear in 2014 is that at this particular point, you actually could also very easily have dammed the river, because by sheer accident, the drainage system for our trenches did become blocked. And just overnight, we had this huge reservoir. And that does help us to explain something that we did find, which is that there are massive, massive deposits, massive alluvial deposits in association with our bridge, probably dating to the 6th century. So probably in the 6th century, the bridge itself was not considered secure enough, and a large reservoir was created. This reservoir would have made it very, very difficult even to approach the Gorgon Wall. It also would have had probably some other side effects. It could have, of course, have been used for irrigation, powering mills, and the like. Just 700 meters to the left is our Fort 2, which we explored via various means, via topographical survey, via drone survey. So David Nashkidashvili took drone photographs of pretty much every well-preserved fort. This is one of the smaller forts on the wall, but if you look at this car here, you probably appreciate it's not small in that sense. It's still 1.2 hectares interior area. And within this fort, we carried out geophysical survey, and this geophysical survey showed to us the interior is fairly disturbed, so I'm not going to bore you with small details, but it showed us very, very clearly some of the towers, the projecting towers on the outside of the fort wall. So on the basis of this, we could reconstruct the towers, and we actually also excavated one of them. Now, what's happening in the interior, we can't really see, but if you look at satellite imagery, it's very, very clear that there are, as usual, two parallel barracks, as is typical for all small forts, two small mounds. So on the basis of this information, and there are faint traces of some walls in the geophysics, we then excavated the trench, and taking all this information together, we have now a fairly detailed idea of the interior occupation of this particular fort. Now, this fort, so you see here in the interior in red, our original barracks, and then in blue, later annexes. So once these annexes were added, we have two barracks about 90 meters long, almost 30 meters wide. The original barracks probably two stories high, the annexes probably just one story. And it is possible there could have been further accommodation on the inside of the fort walls, but we don't know yet. So I haven't plotted those because at the moment that would be pure hypothesis. So what's going on within our barracks? Now, there are very many scholars who say, oh, well, the Gorgon Wall is just far too big. They could not possibly have occupied it. The Sasanians did not possibly have the manpower to allow them to do so, which, of course, raises the question, if you don't have the manpower to occupy the fort, how do you get the manpower to build it? In the first instance, this would have required just as many people to be involved. Now, our excavation did show that the excavations did show that these forts were quite densely occupied. So we have a whole series of ovens, we've got storage pits, and these ovens were rebuilt on at least three separate occasions. So also the occupation is spanning some time, probably starting sometime in the 5th century and extending at least to the 6th, but probably the early to mid 7th century. So here you see the two early phases, and then it gets even busier, probably around the 6th century. Here we've got now 8 ovens in operation at in phase 3. We have one room that's exclusively for storage, so 12 big storage jars. We also have 6 storage pits in our small trench, which suggests maybe there were some 200 or so in the fort as a whole, not all in use necessarily at the same time. So there are evidently quite a lot of mouse to feed, and even in the late phase, we still have lots of makeshift structures. So this fort is occupied quite heavily, maybe for something like 150 years or so. Also quite interestingly, we have a little bit of weaponry, but we also have plenty of evidence for textile working. So I more and more think that what we do have is soldier families. So we don't have an exclusively male garrison. Also, we cannot ultimately prove it, but probably women and children present as well. Answering 2 questions, A, the fort is heavily occupied, heavily used, but also it probably would have been terribly expensive to maintain the garrison, because to some extent, especially during the late phase of occupation, they probably fend for themselves to a large extent. They're not paid in money, and they are producing even some of their textiles themselves. And as Marjan Mashkour's research has shown, they're not very lavishly fed either. So a big garrison, but one that would have been comparatively low maintenance. Here, just a few pictures to illustrate this. So it's 2 of our Iranian team members here very helpfully are posing for purposes of scale in our largest storage pit, just to give you to show you that this is not a small feature. One of our ovens, almost a meter across, which is the typical size, and a whole range of storage jars, all from this one small trench that we've excavated. Now, if you're starting to get bored with forts on the Gorgon Wall, let us move on to sites in the hinterland where we have even much more massive fortifications. This here is Gabri Calais, 36 hectares large, defended by some 90 towers, which you still see surviving as rips in the landscape today. And we sectioned the access causeway, and this yielded radiocarbon dates, establishing that this particular fortifications probably was built in the 4th or the early 5th century, and therefore is earlier than the Gorgon Wall. The Gorgon Wall itself is probably built at some stage between the 420s and the 480s. So we've got a much more detailed insight into the chronology of this huge hinterland fortifications. We also were very fortunate in exploring the largest installations of its kind, the largest enclosure of proper military purpose with no buildings inside. So it wasn't a town as far as we can tell. It's called Kalepul Gunbat Ekavus. And this large fortification yielded from the charcoal buried underneath the wall itself, the wall probably a mere shadow of its former self. We made estimates that it once may have been 10 or 20 meters high. But this charcoal suggests that it was built, that the soil buried for it dates to sometime in the 5th, 6th, or very early 7th century, with the highest probability being probably sometime in the 6th century, probably last 3/4 of the 6th century. So this could be the not just the largest, but possibly also one of the latest sustained fortifications on the Gorgon Wall. Have a look at the ditch, absolutely massive, about 30 meters wide. We didn't reach its bottom. Also, we reached the bottom of our trenches was more than 8 meters below the ancient surface and recut at various stages in the Middle Ages. So still playing a role also in the history of the period of the Caliphate. But if you don't find this impressive in purposes of scale, let us move on to the Tehran Plain, where we've got, not coincidentally, I'm sure, in a similar position as modern capital of Iran, a strategic key position, not far from Ray, we find Kali Iraj, and I should here give full credit to Mohammad Reza Nemati, who is a leading scholar who explored this site ever since about 2005-2006, together with Mehdi Musavinya. So they are the leading scholars. And we were very fortunate in 2016, we were given permission to join them, and we excavated two trenches in one of the gates because we wanted to get precise dating evidence. There's also a preliminary report already in Iran if you want to read more about the site and don't want to wait for another month or so until the book is out. This here is the gate area. This fortress is absolutely massive. It survives to about 50 meters height. Still today, some of those small dots in the entrance areas are the excavators. Very, very impressive fortifications. And our radiocarbon dates indicate that it was built probably around the first third of the fifth century, with likely activity of the site dating back to the 4th century AD. Fascinating also is that, these were found, by Dr. Nemati and written up largely by Professor Carlo Ceretti. There's a collection of ostracas, Sasanian ostraca, from the very same gateway. We found none ourselves. They were all found earlier at a higher level by Dr. Nemati. So if you want to find out more about supplies to such a facility, there will be exciting information for you to read in our forthcoming monograph. But I'm not going to dwell on those right now. But let us briefly move on to a second wall, which is also on the Gorgon Plain. This here is the wall of Tamisha, much shorter. It's a mere 12 kilometers, or about 14 if you include the ditch. So this is the western end of the Gorgon Wall, as far as we know it. Richard Bates, who joined the project, traced it about 5 kilometers further than we had known in four so far, but perhaps even more excitingly, he carried out a sonar survey at the terminal of the Tamisha Wall. Now, the Tamisha Wall already featured quite prominently in our previous phase of the project. You see it as a line here, very straight line, and submerged in the Caspian Sea, we see here a possible fort and the wall continuing, explored by our trench of divers. Now, in this season, we explored more sophisticated methods, namely a sonar survey, and Richard Bates found the possible terminal of the wall about a further kilometer into the sea, terminating roughly where the shoreline would have been the Sasanian era, where the water table was lower in the Caspian Sea than it is today. So this is our preview of most of our Sasanian excavations. And now let me come to some of the broader conclusions that do emerge from our research. Now, one thing that becomes increasingly evident is that we have similar forms of defensive architecture at more than one frontier, not dwelling here on the courtyard forts, which we've looked at initially, which we find all over the place, but looking at the what you could call the bigger guns, the very large fortifications, we've got similar barrack forts on the Gorgon Wall in Upper Mesopotamia. We have this huge campaign bases, such as Gabrikale and Kalepolgon, but many of them on the Gorgon Plain, also on the Tehran Plain, also in Transcaucasia, also in Upper Mesopotamia. We've got bridge barriers on the Gorgon Wall. You've seen one, and we've also got them again in Transcaucasia, and we may have them also further east. So these similar forms of architecture are, to my mind, a strong indications that there's a lot of coordination defensive matters, though those who believe that this is Sasanian Empire was a very loose confederation without a very strong central power might want to look at this evidence. I think there was a lot of central planning, imperial planning involved in imperial defense. And there was investment of a scale that is quite staggering. So on this plan, we've plotted on the same scale a number of Roman and Sasanian forts. So for ease, to make it easier for you, all the ones in regular font are the Sasanian forts, all the ones in italics are the Roman forts. Now, it's not that I've deliberately chose that just to spot small Roman forts. If you leave aside fortress cities, and if you leave aside hilltop fortifications, which are different types of fortifications because fortress cities haven't got an exclusively military garrison, and hilltop fortifications are not normally densely occupied, there is just nothing that is very big in the late Roman state. So our Alesian legionary fortress, which is thought to have housed 1,000 to 2,000 men, you could literally fit 40 times into Kali Iraj. And also Kale Polgon Badekavus is nothing to be disregarded, which you see here. Also, even some of our smaller fortifications, Gabri Kale, is still very substantial. And even our Fort 4 on the Gorgon Wall is still a little bigger than our legionary fortress. Fort 2 is a smaller fort, but also that is quite substantial. Even our small Burak Tape fort, compare this, for example, with this tiny Egyptian fort of the late Roman period. So massive investment. I think it's now true to say that there was probably great investment in military matters in the Sasanian Empire than anywhere else in the Near Eastern or the Mediterranean world. And that may even hold true, even if we include the early Roman Empire. Also, there's more investment than there is in late antiquity. And this is not just because the Sasanians don't know what else to do with their resources, but I think this has a real effect on effective defense. And what we're looking at here is a map of the Sasanian Empire in permanent color is the areas which are controlled for pretty much all of the time, the late Sasanian era, or pretty much all of the Sasanian era, Yemen being conquered in the 570s. In the east, we have territories that are controlled temporarily, but probably lost around the 590s. But in the west, the empire has a dynamism to expand rather massively in the early 7th century. And I would argue that it was able to do so because its core territories were secure, were very hard to conquer from the north. So there's a recent book which argues that, well, the Huns, for example, could very, very easily have overrun the Sasanian Empire, and the Sasanians were just lucky that they didn't choose to do so. I think this is very much a circular argument. If you, for example, if you don't just look at our archaeological evidence, including also the very small Daryali fort that effectively blocked one of the Caucasus passes, think of the siege of Tbilisi, Fort 27, Fort 28, what was a smaller establishment than some of the big fortifications held out against the combined forces of the Western Turkish Khaganate and the late Roman Empire for months until it was eventually captured. So the hypothesis that the Sasanian fortification belt could have very easily overrun, I think, is not persuasive in my view at all. And it's quite interesting that, of course, eventually the fatal attack is not from the north, but from the south of the empire. But let us move on. I mean, this investment in defenses also allows the emergence of large cities such as Yadasht Kale, where we've excavated in the first phase of the project, but the extensive geophysical survey detecting inter alia a previously unknown fire temple. And since it was Andrew Newman who originally invited me to give this lecture, I thought I probably won't get away if I don't mention things that happened in more recent centuries. So I should also alert you to some fortifications that we did explore as part of our project that are of much more recent origins, but which are very, very interesting for the effectiveness and the workings of such monuments in the long durée. Now, on the left side, you see our colleagues, Badia Shabani, Hamid Omrani, Rekhavandi, and our geophysicist, Arman Urshadi, here posing for purposes of scale in front of the Chari Kulbat earthwork. So this is a mere boundary earthwork, probably erected 16th or 17th century. And this particular earthwork, I would argue that there perhaps never would have been a Qajar dynasty ruling over Iran if it hadn't been for this particular earthwork. Because in 1784, Shah of Iran is sending forces to subdue a renegade province at Astarabad, and Astarabad is besieged, and then the forces of Astarabad reoccupy the Chari Kulbat. The cut off supplies, eventually the besieging army is forced to flee. They're decimated at the Chari Kulbat earthwork, and then the ruler of Astarabad founds the Qajar dynasty. So if it hadn't been for the Chari Kulbat earthwork, there never would have been a Qajar dynasty. And I think this is evidence. I mean, those of there are very many scholars who think, oh, well, earthworks are purely symbolic, could not possibly have been defended, have no military purpose, whatever. In the age of firearms, a mere boundary earthwork is proving decisive, then who can doubt that more elaborate defenses such as the Gorgon Wall could have been so too in the age before firearms. And we also explored together with Maizam Labafraniki, the Furut Wall, which is in Khorasan and probably dates to the time of Nadir Shah. And also, if you're interested in recent history, so something for everybody's taste in our book, and I can say this, I receive no royalties from this book, so I'm providing here entirely objective and unbiased advice that you should buy this book. Gabri Kalevich, we've heard about before, is not just of interest for the Sasanian era, it's also of interest for the Ilkhanid era. So we see here a lot of activity along a bustling Bazaar Strait up to the later 13th or the 14th century. We don't quite know what brought it to the end. The Black Death is one of several possibilities, but in any case, it shows the foresight of the Sasanian founders to establish a city that lasted 4,000 years, mirroring in a way events in the Rome period where many towns that still exist today go back to military foundations, such as here this legionary fortress in Lincoln evolving into a town. And there are other examples. So Erin Kala in Azerbaijan and Andrea Ritchie kindly drew my attention to this site. It's of strikingly similar dimensions to our Gorgon Wall forts, and it is probably, quite possibly also a military foundation that evolves into a town. The same could be true about Ulta and Kalasi that has been explored by Dr. Karim Alizadeh. Dashkali, however, seems to be an urban foundation from scratch, showing about the dynamism of the population at the time. So if you want to know more about this, then I would strongly encourage you to read our book, which hopefully should be out in a few weeks' time. I've seen fairly final proofs of it. I'm not going to dwell on the Daryali book, because I'm sure that you all will have read the two reports on the Daryali report cover to cover. And but also, this has also been, if you haven't yet, this also has been out for 2 years and is available in all good bookshops. And it just remains to me to thank everybody who has made this possible. And I'm, of course, not going to read out all those names. So thank you very much for all of you, also especially also the British Institute of Persian Studies for its support ever since the beginning. And I would, our wonderful team, very, very many people involved. So there are more than 100 authors of our book. And it just remains to me to wish you all a happy Nowruz very soon and a prosperous and hopefully peaceful year 1401. And it's hopefully will also be quite early in the year 1401, which will see the publication of our book. And that brings me to the end of our brief presentation jointly with Jebel Nokandi, Hamid Omrani, Rekavandi, and the other Iranian and indeed international colleagues, too numerous to list them all here. So thank you very much indeed for your attention.
Thank you very much, Eberhard. That was a breathtaking and awe-inspiring overview of an extremely long research project. I've said a version of this before, but I think your work is operating on a scale that leaves most archaeologists sort of dumbstruck, in a sense of the degree to which you're able to, you know, leading with your running collaborators, these vast teams of specialists operating across such a vast area. And I think it's extremely impressive to end up with such a you know, a comprehensive overview. So we've received a question, Eberhard. This is a question from John McGuinness.
Okay.
Hello, John. Good evening. Thank you for such an amazing presentation. In the slide on textile production, what are the bow tie shaped objects to the right of the loom weights?
The bow tie shaped objects, I should confess, I mean, that's the one thing which you probably can shoot me down on. I think that is in a way, possibly a little bit of fantasy of my part. It's essentially a stone, which has this particular shape, but we're in a stoneless plane. So there are very few stones from our excavations, and it would have made a perfect loom weight in my mind. But it's probably the least secure of our textile producing implements. We've got, now how many do we have? About a dozen spindle whirls, and we've got one sewing needle. So these are without doubt real textile implements. As to whether our strangely shaped stone was a loom weight or something else, that I think is open to debate.
Thank you, Eberhard. I have several questions, one of which relates to something that you raised, well, I guess an issue that you raised several times. You talked about the fact that the garrison for Fort 2 would have been expensive to maintain. And you also just discussed, well, you made reference to the fact that this, you know, effectively the system that you're in the process of, you know, reconstructing and understanding would have required a major investment. So have you got a bit of an idea in terms of general expense or general cost for what we're talking about? I mean, are we able to put any sort of monetary figure on it, or you know, people involved at any one time? Could you give us some numbers?
Is that too difficult? I think the very short answer on the cop-out would be too difficult, but I'll try to expand a little on that. Monetary, no, I don't think we can. And I think money didn't really change hands as a result of this. So one of the interesting observations is that neither we nor anybody else, to our knowledge, has ever found a single coin on a fort on the Gorgon Wall. Now, I'm somebody who has excavated Roman forts, and I know that in Roman forts, you often find hundreds of coins. We have late antique forts from the Near East. They don't yield necessarily more military equipment than ours, but they yield lots of coins, even the late Roman forts in the Near East. So almost certainly the troop stations there weren't paid in money. Neither can I imagine that the workforce who built the Gorgon Wall was paid in money. So it's essentially a question of resources. It's not that people were paid in order to build the Gorgon Wall. It's that you just need to feed the labor. So it's probably the field armies paid, but not the French garrisons. We attempted to make estimates as to how many people would have been involved for how long for building Kalepulgon, but Ekawus. Anybody who wants to look at such number games is invited to read this particular chapter. So there are certain estimates. And to my embarrassment, I actually now can't even remember myself, but we're really talking about tens of thousands of people being busy probably for maybe many months just to build this one major hinterland fortification. But it would be very nice to do a similar model for all of the Gorgon Wall. I know that there's one colleague I've been speaking with quite a lot who would be quite interesting in doing that. But this is a very complex model because you need to know how long does it take you to fire a brick? How long does it take you to build a brick kiln? How much effort is involved in carrying this brick to the building site? How much do you take for the mud mortar? So we've done models for bits of it. But I haven't yet produced the model as to how much labor. And I think what you really want to look at is workers' days, rather than anything in monetary terms, so how many workers. But I think there is no question that you're talking about probably tens of thousands, and you're probably talking about a few years.
Excellent. Okay, no, thank you. I realize it wasn't a deliberately tricky question, but it was, yeah. I think in a sense, you're emphasizing the scale of the endeavor. So we've got another question from Isabel Miller, who's asked, is there evidence that these forts were also part of the fight against the Arab advance, or did they only ever operate looking outwards, as it were, towards the north.
These particular forts, we have no evidence that they played any role to fight against the Arab advance. In effect, I would argue that there probably are various factors which did contribute to the Arab victory, such as the mutually most calamitous war which the late Roman and the Sasanian Empire ever fought against each other in the early 7th century. Perhaps a certain neglect of the southern frontiers, if you look at what we do have in defenses in the south, it's not as substantial as we do have in the north, even so urban fortifications still slow down the Arab advance. I think the Golden Wall eventually falls because the Golden Wall is losing its hinterland. We cannot date with precision how long the Golden Wall remains occupied. We have radiocarbon dates which date the latest occupation of Fort 4 to somewhere between the first decade or so of the 7th century and the middle of the 7th century. So that leaves the possibility that it could have been abandoned in already while the Sasanian Empire's advanced to the west, but I think it's much very unlikely it would have been abandoned before the 630s at the earliest. So the garrison may have been withdrawn, it may have melted away as the Golden Wall lost its hinterland, but I think by the time the Arab forces are reaching the Golden Wall, which incidentally the Golden Plain only becomes part of the Caliphate, of course, in the 8th century, And initially, it's part of a Turkish principality, which is when Balaturi refers to that. So I think the garrison of the Golden Wall, we have no evidence that they were involved in a fight against the invaders from the south.
Okay. Oh, thank you. I mean, that question and that answer rolls into the next question that's been asked by Ina Artsen. Thank you for the presentation. When it comes to the Gorgan Wall, is there evidence that it was built as a defense against the Hephthalites? And did they play an important role when it comes to the Göktürk Khaganate?
It was built, it was definitely built at the time when the Hephthalites do make an appearance. So we can now say quite definitely that it's... occupation radiocarbon dates, of course, have the problem that between the 420s and the 530s, there's a plateau in the radiocarbon calibration curve. So no matter how many dates you process, you will never get a more precise date than that. It's precisely at some stage in this 110-year period or so. We've got plenty more of those, but we've got some of those already quite high up in our stratigraphy, in our most recent date. And that has much increased the probability of what we've argued before, which is that the Golden Wall was almost certainly built in the 5th century. So in any case, it was before the Turkish Khaganate does appear on the scene, but it's still heavily occupied, while the Turkish Khaganate then also forces a formidable opponent. I'm inclined to think that when Tabari, for example, writes that in the 560s, the Turks are unable to make any inroads, that there's probably a significant element of truth in it. So I think it played still a very important role in the 6th century. And in effect, I think most of the occupation that we can date probably belongs to the 6th century.
Thank you. So there's a follow-up question by Simon Corcoran. Is there any evidence for signaling or other communication systems along the fortifications?
No, unfortunately, not really, because this is... one of our lacunae is we don't really know about towers on the Gorgon Wall. So unlike the Hun Wall, where we've got these beacon towers along the wall, and unlike various Roman barriers, where there has been a lot of research about intervisibility between towers, we know very little about towers on the Gorgon Wall, except that some of the aerial images do suggest that they may have existed. But this is really something, if we can get the funding to get back, that's one of many questions that would be worth exploring. Given the fact that it's a fairly flat landscape, it should have been possible actually to signal from one fort to the next. So signaling transmissions certainly should have been possible between the forts. I'm also wondering, for example, when we got this early system, for example, Turang Tape, arguably the most famous fort on the Golden Plain, explored by Rémy Bougelat and others for a long time. That, of course, occupies an early prehistoric settlement mound with white views. And I'm inclined to think that this may have been in signaling contact with other forts, so that this may have been a relay in the hinterland. But we know very little about signaling along the Gorgon Wall, unfortunately.
No, okay. No, I think that's very clear. So Chris Bradley's asked, is there a natural barrier at the eastern end of the Gorgon Wall, so where it encounters?
Yes. There is a natural barrier. You also, in our book, you will see a drawn image of the barrier, but you see a picture of the frog perspective already in the 2013 book. The Gorgon Wall terminates in the east, as far as we know, at a vertical rock face. So it, first of all, continues to the Pishkama rocks, which is a major obstacle. Then east of it, it continues for another 16 or 17 kilometers. And then at the eastern end of this, there's a vertical rock face. There is no evidence for certain yet that it continues beyond, but I'm more and more inclined to think that it forms part of a system and that some of the canals or oasis walls further east form part of a bigger system. And to my knowledge, no systematic survey has ever been carried out to the east in the forested area beyond this vertical rock face. So it's not absolutely certain that it terminates there, but it certainly would have been very difficult to bypass. And that's also true for the Tamisha Wall. So that leads up a fairly steep slope in the Alborz and terminates at the Tower Mount or small fortlet, and then a ditch continues further up. So you would have had to venture into difficult mountainous terrain if you wanted to bypass it.
You know, excellent. I mean, I actually have a slight, well, in some ways it's a related question. So I think it is very interesting what you're describing as a combination of, in some respects, natural fortifications or the use of hills and uplands as required, and then you know, even thinking about Dariali, and then you've got the sort of flatlands where you need a wall to keep people out. And I'm curious about what happens further to the east at the other end of the Kopet Dag, especially around an area like Herat. Is there any evidence for fortification walls along the bottom end of the plains?
Yeah, I'm very glad you mentioned Herat, because there's a very interesting article by Franz Grenet last year in this Italian volume last year, and he argues Herat, which has a geometric plan, may be a Sasanian foundation. And I think it may well be a Sasanian, I mean, I don't know enough about Herat, but Herat may well be a Sasanian military fortification that grows into a town, quite similar to Erin Kala, quite similar to Gabri Calais. So we've probably got a system that relies on individual fortification, this particular area. Further north, I think Warwick Ball has found a Sasanian fort not far from the Rocky Bibi Sasanian rock relief. And if you go much further north, then you've got various oasis walls around Bukhara, Samarkand, some of them also linear, some of them dating to the late antique period. They would have been formed part of this defensive perimeter, I would have thought. Also, of course, bearing in mind that if you do want to operate with a large army, you cannot really lead them across the desert for any very great distance because you can't feed your men. So in a way, if you heavily fortify the oasis, it's very, very difficult for people to make inroads. Mm. But I think in this area, they rely more on punctual defense rather than on the same sort of linear barriers that we do find in the West. I'm glad you mentioned Dariali, of course, in the Caucasus. In a way, it's easier. I mean, you still have to actually control the Caucasus, right, to the mountain passes, which no Eastern Empire does before the Sasanian Empire to the same extent. I mean, the Parthians and the Achaemenids do control bits of Transcaucasia, but to our knowledge, the Sasanian Empire is the first that that really controls the abandoned Dariali, and not only does that, but also strongly fortifies them. So here you can really plug the gaps in the mountain passes via military investment. And it's quite possible that also the Hilaki Wall, which is a wall on the Black Sea, could also seems to be late antique. There have been various hypotheses, is it Roman, is it Sasanian, but it is at least possible that it dates to this brief period when also the area of Lazica, which is Western Georgia, was under Sasanian control. So at some stage, they may have plucked pretty much every easily accessible route across the Caucasus. So you're probably still, I mean, of course, colleagues who say not incorrectly, you can cross the Caucasus on various mountain passes, but of course you do take, A, you exhaust your horses, and secondly, of course, you do take a big risk, because if it snows and then you have to make a sudden escape across a mountain pass in snow and ice, maybe you won't survive. So I think controlling the main passes is done for a rational purpose.
I'm always fascinated about these possibilities. I'm interested about Herat. I mean, that's an exciting possibility. So Alistair Northage is pushing us in different directions, or pushing you in different directions.
Okay.
So he's asked, the Gorgon Wall seems to be very much more impressive than the remains of the Kandak Shapur on the Euphrates.
Yeah.
And to the west, facing the Arab desert. You didn't mention this wall, but have you thought about that area, that subject?
I did indeed think about the Khandak Shapur, and I indeed didn't. It is discussed in our book. The Khandak Shapur, of course, has been very interesting research recently, which has yielded radiocarbon dates from the canal along the Khandak Shapur. And they show that the system was in operation by the fifth or the sixth century, but of course it's only terminus antiquum for its construction. So it's possible that it's a traditional attribution to Shapur the second, probably after the time when he is supposed to have led a war in 325 and at the age of just 16. So it could date to the 4th century, we cannot prove it. The Khandak Shapur, of course, in a way, is a different type of barrier. It's a canal. In a way, it's quite similar to a system which the Sasanian army also uses quite successfully when the Roman Emperor Julian embarks on what proves to be a suicide mission in 363, invades Persia. He finds that at various stages the Sasanian flood land to impede progress of the invasion army, and he does find that various watercourses, canals, make it actually very difficult for him to make progress, and eventually he cannot take the major Sasanian cities. So water is used as an effective obstacle at the Khandak Shapur, possibly at a similar time in Mesopotamia. And again, if you write with our reservoir in the 6th century on the Gorgon Wall, so you create big reservoirs so you can't even get near a weak point in the Gorgon Wall. The Khandak Shapur, in a way, seems to be on a smaller scale, but I do believe that one of the sources also refers to watchtowers. I could misremember this along the Khandak Shapur. There's, of course, a whole range of fortifications alongside it. So it's okay. It's a sort of a chain of forts, which is quite typical for how you defend the desert frontier, similar to the Strata Diocletiana in Syria, and probably not too dissimilar to the system of a network of forts that we see in probably also in the Gorgon Plain shortly before the Gorgon Wall is built. So here again, if it's alongside the old Gorgon River, it's not too dissimilar to building a canal, but of course the canal is on a much more ambitious scale.
So that's really interesting. So you talked about using water as a defense in certain contexts. So the next question from François Gurney is actually asking a question, why is the Gorgon Wall built on the north side of the Gorgon River rather than on the south side where it could use the river as part of the fortification?
Yeah, that's I think is a quite straightforward one to answer. If you build it on the south side of the Gorgon River, that has a whole series of disadvantages. Firstly, The Gorgon River itself is outside the defended perimeter, and you probably want to take advantage of the Gorgon River because, of course, that's quite a good, useful area to grow crops in. Secondly, from a defensive point of view, if you build it on the south side of the Gorgon River, you have many more river crossings. So the north side of the Gorgon River, there are only a handful of major river crossings. And we've seen from our Gorgon Wall Bridge that how much effort you have to invest in order to plug them quite effectively. So why waste the energy if you can do it much more effectively on the opposite side of the river? The only one argument really for building it on the south side of the river, it's probably easier to get wood to it on the north side, and we didn't really touch upon this in this lecture, but effectively there are massive aqueducts being constructed which cross the Gorgon River Valley and which channel water all the way to the Gorgon Wall, because you need flowing water, not just for defensive purposes, but much more fundamentally, in order just to have water to produce mud bricks. And without the mud bricks, you can't build the Gorgon Wall. There's no stone. My understanding is that you can really only produce mud bricks in the dry season, because they won't, if you try it in winter when there may be enough natural water from rainfall, they will not dry. So you need a big canal. So that's the only reason why you might want to build it south of the Gorgon River, but pretty much every other reason would make it more advantageous to build it on the north side of the Gorgon River.
Thank you very much, Eberhard. Some of you may have heard bells ringing in the background. It's now 6 p.m. in the United Kingdom, and that's the end of the allocated time for the session. I would like to thank everybody for asking those questions. I think we drew out a lot of interesting dynamics and extra pieces of information. I'd like to thank Eberhard for answering them. And I'd also like Eberhard for not only presenting the overview of his book, but also for actually completing the research and publishing it in such a timely manner. It's truly an outstanding achievement. And it's a really excellent example of the way that research can and perhaps should be carried out. And I'd just like to thank you very much on behalf of myself and also on behalf of the British Institute for Persian Studies. Thank you.
I would like to thank you very much, Cameron, also for being the series editor and having done so much for seeing all our multiple British Institute of Persian Studies monograph series through the press, which is much appreciated, and I shall keep silence about an old project which I'm years behind on publishing. So I think the quite as exemplary as I would like it to be, but I do appreciate the compliment, and we're very glad that to a very significant measure, I should say, to the Iranian colleagues who've done an enormous amount of the research. So they say, I haven't written it all on my own. They've done a lot of the writing. They've done a lot of the research. Without them, there would be nothing to present. So many thanks to very many people who have made this possible.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Eberhard. And thank you, everyone. We'll bid you farewell. And till the next time. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.